In this episode, we will learn about ways of becoming happier at work and ideas to help you with your job search. Let's get started. Struggling to land that big promotion or find that perfect new job? Looking for strategies and practical steps to help you succeed? This is the Reframe and Reset Your Career podcast. I am your host, Harsha Boralesa, and we're here to help. Thank you for joining me today. Here are some highlights of today's episode.
It was a lesson that I should never wait around for someone else to tell me what to do. If you're looking into a new role, don't expect that you'll be able to tick the box on every single requirement. It's not usually a people issue, it's a process issue. I much prefer to focus on what actually went wrong here, how can we make sure it doesn't happen again, and how can we look to the future?
Welcome to the Reframe and Reset Your Career podcast. Our guest today is Aoife O'Brien. Before we begin, I wanted to thank all the listeners of the podcast for their continuing support. I hope you've had a chance to check out my new website. Please note that in this episode, we may touch on mental health and wellness topics purely in general terms. If you have specific issues or concerns, please contact a suitable professional. Now back to the show. Aoife is the founder of Happy at Work, formerly Empowerment Coaching, and host of the fabulous podcast of the same name. She has over 20 years of identifying and solving business problems for global organizations such as Unilever, Mars, Coca-Cola, and Kraft Heinz. She believes that to get the best out of your employees, you need to put people first and create an environment where they can thrive. This results in a happier workplace and increased productivity, engagement, and retention, ultimately impacting on your bottom line. She has an MSc in Work and Organizational Behavior from Dublin City University and is a member of the CIPD. Welcome, Aoife.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Loved our interview on your podcast and also loved our three-year anniversary special as well. So thank you so much for taking the time to do that.
No problem at all. And for anyone who hasn't checked out that episode, there's loads of practical tips from Harsha. So tables have turned and I did an interview with Harsha on his own podcast. So definitely go and check that out.
Fantastic. So I'm a big fan of the arts, Aoife. Is there a performer, song, book or film which you'd like to share with the listeners?
Do you know what? When we did our interview, when I interviewed you and you said Inception, I was like, oh, he's stolen my thunder now. Inception is my, like, it's really up there. I'm a huge fan of Christopher Nolan, any of his Batman movies. I absolutely love Inception. So, like, for me, it's the whole concept of the dream within a dream. And then you get to the end of, I don't want to do any spoilers, but you kind of are wondering also, is this also a dream? Like, has this whole, what we perceive as reality, been a dream as well? Just the entire concept of time as well, and how time moves and how we can influence other people by having inception into their, you know, incepting into their brain, whatever it might be, giving people ideas. But yeah, I just love it. Like the action and the direction and the filming of it and all of the concepts and the music. And yeah, I just absolutely love it.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan too. And the whole idea of time, and there always seems to be some sort of loss. The characters are looking for something to change something in their past. So yeah, there's this huge emotional element. Great choice. Back to the start, you graduated with a degree in international business with Spanish and German. Now that's an amazing combination. Was there any specific strategy behind that, Aoife?
I would say no. I would cast my mind back to when I was 18 years old or, you know, choosing what I wanted to do for university. No strategy whatsoever. I was always very strong at science subjects and math subjects, as I know you were as well. I was really keen to go down the communications route. And communications, I don't know, is a kind of a common terminology, but it'd be things like radio and media and that kind of thing. Now, my maths teacher, having had a conversation with my mum, obviously, pulled me aside one day and said, I hear you want to go and do media studies. I don't think that's a good idea because you're so good at maths. Now, he was kind of gearing me more towards the maths or the engineering side of things. I didn't see that the potential there. And at the time, IT had really started to take off, but I had some really terrible advice from a friend's mum to say, IT is going nowhere. You don't want to go down that route either. And so I felt that doing business was sort of a happy medium. it had some things that I was interested in. So it had the maths part, it had the psychology part. I didn't think too much about business, and I certainly hadn't studied business in school like some of my friends had. And the languages piece was, again, you know, people, this advice from other people, well-meaning advice saying, oh, languages are going to be really important. And I had studied German in school and I'd never studied Spanish, but I know Spanish is so widely spoken. Yes. And coming full circle now, and I'm living in the Canaries, and my Spanish is coming in really useful, you know, 20 something years later, which is great. But back to your original question, was there a strategy? Not really. I just wanted to find that happy medium of something that I knew I would excel in and something that I enjoy doing. And the languages piece never really fared, only that I can have a conversation with my sister-in-law, who is German, not that we speak in German very much. And the Spanish, now that I'm living in Spain, has really kind of come back to me as well. So rather from a business perspective, but more from a personal perspective.
I think there's some great points there, because I think a point I'd like to emphasize to our listeners is that there are a lot of people who don't have a grand plan at the start of their lives. And even maybe in their 30s, they don't have a grand plan.
Yeah.
But it's actually trying to figure out what you're good at, maybe trying to major in that. But even when you're doing that and progressing in your career, it's worthwhile looking to the side. So many of us don't have that fully formed plan right at the start of our careers, do we?
Yeah, I think we're probably a bit too young to know that or to realize. And I know certainly for me, the reason for not wanting to do, say, a pure maths degree or a pure engineering was I didn't want to become a maths teacher, which is what I perceived a maths degree to be, which in retrospect, I can see that that's not all it's good for. I was really keen to do psychology, actually, and call it self-rejection. But I was like, I'm never going to get the points. We have a point system in Ireland. I'm never going to get the points to do that. So I won't go for that. And then on the engineering, I didn't want to become an engineer. But again, I see that it going to university is more about learning how to learn and learning some very specific skills that you can take into the workplace. And I can see then the types of careers that people have had. So going into very prestigious organizations after having done a maths degree or an engineering degree, when, you know, they're not going in to be a maths teacher, they're not going to be an engineer, for example, but they're going into what is perceived to be a highly prestigious and sought after role straight out of university.
But it's funny that now you're sort of in communication now that you've built a podcast, you've got a YouTube channel. Exactly.
It's not lost on me that it's gone completely full circle now that I'm gone. I feel like I'm almost gone back to my roots with that. No, totally not lost on me that that's happened. And I'm kind of like, well, I could have done this 20 years ago, but I'm not going down that road. I'm not even thinking about that.
Fantastic. So I believe that you had an ambition to work in London, Aoife, is that right? And and how was that transition from Dublin to London?
Yeah, so straight out of college, I suppose I'd love again to share the transition from college into or university into working life, I suppose. Like, I feel like, and I was just chatting to a college friend of mine the other day about this, that they have all these milk rounds. I don't know if you call it the same thing
exactly,
in the UK. The milk rounds. Yeah. I completely missed all of that in the year that I was, quote unquote, supposed to have done it. So I missed all of those kind of big opportunities to join a bank or an investment bank or one of the big four like yourself. I completely missed that. I was just oblivious to what was going on around me. Completely missed that. So when I finished college, I was doing a bit of travel. I was taking some time out, and then I got in on the milk round on the second kind of go around. I applied for all of the things that I hadn't applied for the previous year. It was a slow start, let's say, but eventually I ended up in a category role. It was more of kind of a sales, like a sales rep, but using category knowledge, which I found really interesting. So you're kind of using all of this data from actual sales, and you're making these sales pitches to people on the floor to stock more of the products, basically. So it was a beer company that I was working for at the time. And I always had this ambition to live in London. I had an aunt who lived in London. I used to go there all the time as a kid. And I think the perception is that being from Dublin, Dublin is probably considered the big smoke in Ireland. But for me, London is kind of the big smoke. It's like
the New York.
Next step up. It's London or New York. Maybe New York is another big step up from London, you know. But I always had this ambition to go to London. And when I finally decided that I was going to go to London, my friend said, "Oh, like, wow, I'm surprised it's taking you so long because you've been talking about this for years." I was waiting for someone to grab me by the hand and say, "Come on, Aoife, now we're going to London." I was just waiting around for someone to do that rather than taking the responsibility myself. So that was a huge, huge lesson for me. I got to London. I loved it from day one. I absolutely loved it. I loved taking the tube. I loved how big it was. I loved all of the opportunities that were there. And for me, when I look back, it was one of the best times of my life. I absolutely loved living there. I stayed with my aunt for the first few months when I lived there. And then I got a place of my own, by which I mean a shared flat as opposed to a place. I don't think I would ever be able to afford a place of my own in London. It was just such a fantastic experience. I loved the work that I did there. I loved the culture of the organization that I worked in. And I felt like it was the start of my life. Like I really blossomed while I was living there, I think.
But I love that point you're making about sort of waiting for somebody to take you.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people are waiting around for that opportunity or that perceived opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think a message that I try to get across on this podcast, and I'm sure it's the same with you, is this idea of empowerment and taking control of the situation. Yeah. And you may not always make the right decision, but I think you feel a lot better if you're the one who's take action rather than waiting for somebody else to guide you in a particular direction. What do you think, Aoife?
Yeah, like for me, like I say, it was a huge lesson for me. It was a lesson that I should never wait around for someone else to tell me what to do or to do something that it is that I want to do. I should just take control of that. And I think that's shaped my subsequent experiences of my life. If I think of anything that I did since then, I love London so much. The initial plan was to stay for about a year. The sterling is obviously always a really great currency to earn because it transfers quite well. You can make a lot of money. So my initial plan was to stay for around a year, earn money and then travel. I was planning to head off to Australia and work and live there as well as a real kind of rite of passage. But I was enjoying London so much that I ended up staying for 3.5 years. The only reason that I left London was because at that time, you had to apply for your Australian visa before you turned 30. Before you turn 30 and then you have a year to activate the visa. So I applied anyway before I turned 30. And then, I left London before I turned 31 and I traveled all around. But again, I wasn't waiting for someone's permission to do that. I was like, this is something I've always wanted to do. Even if I'm doing it on my own, I'm going to go and do it.
No, I love that independent spirit. And I was looking at your background and you seem to have done a lot of traveling and sort of married that with working as well.
Yeah.
You sort of worked in Australia, you worked in Asia, but then you traveled around. And I just love the way that you've managed to combine those two things.
Yeah. I was always interested in travel. My dad, when he was working, he's retired now, but he was a pilot. And I don't know, does it come from that we always would have traveled abroad when we were younger?
Yes.
I know certainly when I was in university, I lived and worked abroad every summer. I did an Erasmus year in Barcelona because I was studying the Spanish. So I was always interested in exploring the world and in meeting people. So on my way to Australia, I traveled for around 6 months around Southeast Asia.
Yeah, cool.
Landed in Perth. And anticipated that, you know, I'll just stay here and I'll meet up with friends and things. But after 6 months of living out of a backpack, I was like, no, I'm done here. I have to get a job. I have to settle down, hang up my clothes and have a proper towel and all the things that you take for granted, I think. You have a place to do my laundry. You don't realize, but for me, I think I get to about 5 months, probably less now that I'm older. But at that time, I got to about 5 months and I was like, now I just need to stay in the same place for a little while. While I was in Australia, I was there for 2.5 years. I worked in Perth for 6 months. I traveled the West Coast, which is less touristy, let's say. There's not as many people traveling around there, and certainly not the southwest. So I traveled down around the southwest of Australia. But I worked in Sydney then for about a bit less than 18 months. And that is what kind of put me on the path, if you like, that I'm on now, where up until that point, like I said, I had that job in London, and I loved my job in London. It was such a nice culture. I felt like I was doing really well at work. I probably, similar to yourself, wasn't always progressing at the speed that I would like because of a change in manager, you know, that frustrating thing where one manager is making promises, then they leave or they change roles and you get a new manager and you have to build yourself up all over again. So I had a couple of things like that. And then when I landed in Perth, it was something very, very different that I did there. It was recruitment administration in a mining contracting company. So they would go out and pitch for contracts. And then if they won the contracts, it was the recruiter's job to try and fill those with the miners. Yeah. So, well, if you think like there's so many different roles, which again is so eye-opening to me. In my mind, miner is North England and coming out of a coal mine with a dirty face or something. Do you know what I mean? That was my perception. Yes. But this is oil and gas mining, and they need scaffolders and they need painters. There was all these. So it was a real eye-opening thing. But again, such a nice culture, such a nice atmosphere at work, really supportive. And apparently, and I'm not saying there's any relationship between this, just to be really clear, but apparently after I left, the culture sort of changed. So over time, there was change in management and things like that. Yep. And so it just goes to show the importance of a culture, and how I remember that so fondly is because it was such a nice place to work. Anyway, fast forward, I landed in Sydney, and straight away, I could detect that there was something that wasn't quite right. And for me, totally toxic culture, very misogynistic. There was a really high turnover rate of staff as well. Within a couple of months, people who had been there for way longer than I had were approaching me to ask me questions about how to do things. And I thought that's really strange. That they're like, should they not know this already? But to me, looking back now, it shows that I picked things up really quickly and I was just kind of getting on with it. I learned all of the technology, the software really quickly, and they gave me 5 days of client work. This is kind of what I'm remembering now. They gave me 5 days of client work, and I was kind of, you know, obviously saying it to the wrong people in order to change it, but I was having a bit of a moan about like, well, why do I have so much work when, you know, there's 5 days in a week? When am I going to have my meetings? When is the travel time? When is the when's my personal development? When's my learning? All of that kind of thing. There was no factoring in of that at all. But when I look back, I'm grateful, because the two major questions I had after working there was, what could I have done differently in my career to manage this better? And again, if I want to play devil's advocate with that, is when we find ourselves in those types of situations, we tend to blame ourselves. So I was blaming myself for having got myself into this situation. So that's kind of an alternative perspective, if you like. But I still have that overarching question, what could I have done differently to manage my career better and not enter into this toxic situation or manage it better, whatever it might be? But equally, from an organization's perspective, what could they have done differently? Because I left in less than 18 months. They had sponsored my visa. They had obviously provided training and paid me a salary. So me leaving in less than 18 months must have cost them at least a little bit of money, because I was taking the relationships, I was taking the knowledge that I had built, all of the kind of intangible assets, if you like, that you build up over time working in an organization. So again, the two overarching questions, what could I have done differently to manage my career better? But equally, what could the organization have done differently? And if we're going back, say, about 12 years, like that's when all of this went down. And if I think, those underlying questions have been burning inside me since then. And it's kind of spurred me on to kind of the path that I'm on now.
Is that what led you to start your business, Happy at Work, Aoife? That was the whole idea of managing toxic working environments, improving them, making them better?
Interestingly, so I left Australia altogether. I traveled around more. So I did another about year of traveling after there. While I was living in Sydney, I traveled around New Zealand for the Rugby World Cup, which was on at the time in 2011, which was incredible. And then on my way back home, let's say, so either back home to Dublin, where I live or where I'm from, Dublin or London, where I had come from, and then New York, where I've always wanted to live. So there were kind of three options as I saw them. But I traveled around. I went to Hawaii. I went to the west coast of the States and Canada and the east coast as well. I went home for Christmas, and then I came back and I traveled all around South America. So like, I really had a fantastic time. And then I came back and I started a role in Dublin. Again, I kind of landed while I was traveling. I was like, oh, I think it's time to go back to Dublin. It doesn't have to be forever, but I'll go back to Dublin. So I went back to Dublin and I took another role. And I know we've kind of talked about this before, but I felt in that time I wasn't really working to my strengths. Yes, and there was something I couldn't quite place my finger on, and it just wasn't really the right environment for me. So in some ways I found myself in a toxic environment again, but not toxic, but toxic for me, in that it wasn't the right environment. And these questions started to come up again. What could I have done differently? What should the organization be doing? And eventually, after 4.5 years, I left without anything to go to, with zero plan. I had no intentions of setting up in business, but I went on to do a diploma in coaching and started my master's in organizational behavior. And while I was doing the master's, it all kind of clicked. It was the psychology piece that I had never studied earlier at university, only kind of a little bit. There was the people piece, understanding people and how they behave at work. And then there was the research piece, which is what I had spent my entire career doing, the data, the analysis, turning information into stories that people can use and implement. And it was only then that I set up in business. As you mentioned at the start, started out with empowerment coaching. I thought I was going to change the world one person at a time, helping people with their careers. I quickly realized it's as a business model, it's not a great way to have a sustainable business, for want of a better word. In other words, it's really hard to make money doing one-to-one coaching when there's all of these other aspects of a business. People don't want to pay too much money for one-to-one coaching, even though it's really valuable for them. So it's kind of evolved over time. I started the podcast, Happier at Work, and then I changed the name of my business to Happier at Work. Someone just said, I was trying to come up with all these other fancy names, Empowerment Solutions, because I don't want to just focus on coaching. And someone said, why don't you just call it Happier at Work, the same as your podcast? And I was like, oh, isn't that a genius idea? So that's what I did. And it sort of evolved now. So the most recent iteration of Happier at Work in general, like, I knew I always wanted to get to some sort of a technology solution. So helping people to, from an individual perspective, to manage their careers a bit more strategically, thinking about what are the things that they need to do to get from A to B? How can I, as an individual, manage my career? How do I know that this organization that I'm interested in working in is going to be a good fit for me? How do I, as an organization, bring the right people? It's not the best talent, it's the right talent into the organization. So for me, from the research that I did for my master's, it's about values alignment and then a strengths focus. So that's from the hiring perspective. It's understanding, what are our values as an organization? How are they lived and experienced at work? Do people feel our values? Or do they think, well, you say that that's your value, but actually it's not really my lived experience? So making sure that that's right first. And then when it comes to hiring, making sure that you're bringing people in whose values align with those of the organization. And I think there's a lot of organizations that don't do this. They don't get it right. They ask competency-based questions. They don't necessarily focus on the values and the behaviors that are expected at work. Or if they do ask behavior-based questions, it's hypothetical type of things rather than sharing experiences that have been the reality for the person. So I'm hoping to create eventually a technology solution that will solve for that specific problem. The other aspect that came up in my research was this idea of needs satisfaction at work, which I don't hear anyone talking about. So we all have needs at work. You might not know or be able to articulate what your needs are, but you know when you feel frustrated. at work. You know that there's something going on. You're like, oh, that's really annoying. And I know that you've had a previous podcast guest, Vanessa Patrick, who talked about this idea of saying no versus yes, and the art of saying no. And we often say yes when we people please. But if you think about those things you're saying yes to, and then going in and complaining to someone else about the fact that you've got so much work, or your boss isn't letting you off, you've done that to yourself. There's no other way to say that. But when you feel frustrated about those things, you have to think about what one of my needs is not being met here, or is there something that I need to dial up to take kind of more responsibility for that as well. So they're the kind of the three main elements, if you like. But then there's the underlying element of psychological safety. So we have to have an environment where it's okay to speak up. And again, on one of your previous podcast episodes, I heard this topic specifically coming up, where they were talking about noticing when you're taking things offline and you've had a conversation in the room and you want to say something, but you think, I'm going to hang on and we're going to have a separate conversation afterwards. It's catching yourself in the moment and saying, no, we have to have that conversation now. We can't have that conversation offline. This needs to be brought up into the room. So creating that environment for people to be able to do that, I think, is so important. And then overarching is leadership, making sure that we have the right people in place to lead these conversations, to lead these types of behaviors, and to manage it all effectively as well. So I've just kind of given you a whistle-stop tour of the Happier at Work framework without really being prompted. But thank you for the opportunity to share that.
And funny enough, Aoife, I actually bumped into Amy Edmondson at a conference literally a month ago. And the bizarre thing was that I was having coffee and I saw that she was on the next table. So I just had to go and say hello and introduce myself. I mean, she's probably got that, hundreds of people going up to her and saying hello. But it's funny how you've heard about psychological safety and all these other things, and then you meet the person themselves.
Yes. How would you call it? The founder, not quite the founder, or not quite.
Well, it's like Carol Dweck with mindset. It's the person who started these ideas off.
Exactly.
I think there's so many interesting things that come up there. But yeah, I mean, especially I think with leadership and leaders, because they do set the tone for the organization. Yeah. And you look at what is the leader doing. So if he's saying, okay, we've got a culture of openness and we treat people fairly, but then if he's being misogynistic, or he's making unpleasant comments, or he's just not walking the walk.
Exactly.
So I think it's really important for the leader to set the tone, to set the values, and say, this is how we're going to behave. Because I also think that sometimes you come to these situations where people have choices about their actions. And usually when things go wrong, sometimes it's at the sort of maybe middle manager or slightly junior level. You're in a situation where you have difficult decisions and you have to make a decision in the moment. Yeah. And then if you know the value of the company and say you feel comfortable to say, ask your boss, should I be doing this? And checking with them, because it's always good to have two pairs of eyes on a decision. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when junior people, I'm not saying they shouldn't have responsibility, but if they feel they can't ask their superiors, then you're in a worrying situation in a company. Yeah. And that's where I think bad things happen.
That's such a good point. I think either you go to your manager and they say, I don't have time for that, I can't help you, or they sit down, or they kind of make a better decision. But oftentimes managers don't have a lot of time. So I think it's about, as an individual contributor, choosing your battles, for want of a better word. How high stakes is this decision? And what research have I done up to now? So that I'm not just coming to my manager and saying, I have this decision to make and I haven't really given it any thought. It's I've investigated option X, Y, and Z, and I think we should go for Z, but actually I just wanted to get your input to make sure my thinking is okay on this. So it takes much less time, and the manager doesn't then have to take their time investigating all of the different potential opportunities with it, that they can trust you to kind of make that decision. I think the kind of manager-employee relationship it's such an important one, and it's so hard to get right sometimes as well. And in doing the research that I did for my master's, one of the aspects, and the reason I did the research I did, so I don't think we kind of touched on that, but I did this research into this concept called fit. And what I was looking at was environmental, person-environment fit. And that is like the person in the environment that they were in. It seemed to most closely match the issues that I had had at work. And one of the other aspects to look at was this idea of a person job fit or a person supervisor fit as well. It's so brilliant that you brought up this concept of values, because when someone behaves in a way that is not aligned with the values, everyone can see that it's going on. So it has to be addressed and nipped in the bud. And people need to know that that sort of behavior is not tolerated and it's been stamped out here. But if it's allowed to go on, then other people see that that's allowed to happen and they will replicate that behavior. And soon you'll find yourself in a toxic working environment. Interestingly, to go back to your earlier point of, is that why I set up in business? Because I wanted to stamp out toxic environments. I think I was sort of allergic to ever dealing with a toxic environment again. So I didn't want to. But for me, oftentimes the people who work with me are, say, new HR leaders into their roles and they want to make a really good impression. It's coming more from a positive place rather than I've walked into this toxic situation and I need to fix it. If that makes sense. So then coming back to your idea of the kind of the leader and the individual contributor, I think leaders need to make that time. And it's hard because most of the time these days, and I recently interviewed someone for the podcast whose exclusive role is to lead a team. He doesn't have any sort of job related responsibilities except for leadership, which is incredible. And I think that's the way things should go for certain individuals, if that's kind of where their skills lie. But oftentimes it's finding that balance between having time for your team and having time to do your day-to-day role. And I say this as someone who struggles with this personally, but it's so important to empower your team up front and give them that time so that further down the line, they're going to be able to solve those kinds of problems for themselves. No matter how long it takes, you need to devote that time to them so that they learn.
Yeah, I think that's a great lesson for leaders, that if you put in that initial investment up front and also make your team feel comfortable that they can come to you, they may not use that, but then at least in the back of their mind, they'll know that Aoife, she's cool. If I've got a real problem, I can always go to her, because you have that sense of comfort. And then you're not always second guessing yourself, because there are certain situations where it is a very subjective call, and it's always better to get somebody else in there to just look over it. And I always prefer, when I'm working with somebody, even on the podcast, if I've got some people helping me on something, I would much prefer that they flag up an issue straight away and say, look, this is a potential issue. What do you think? Rather than then spending a day stewing about it.
That is a common mistake early career, I think, that you want to hide any mistakes rather than flagging them early. And I think you quickly realize that that's not a good approach to have at all. Managers would rather hear about the mistakes that you've made quickly and try and fix them. And they can probably get to the root cause or the heart of the matter a lot more quickly than you can, with the kind of the ruminating and the whatever thinking got you into that situation in the first place. So I think it's really important to flag those things. And even as senior managers as well, sometimes we kind of want to hide our mistakes, but unless, and this comes up a lot, I think, unless you're in this life and death situation, which most organizations are not, then you have to not have a laugh about it, but you have to not take yourself so seriously. Like, you can always explain to a client, or you can always explain to someone internally, like, this is what happened, this is what's gone wrong. Something else that I'm learning more and more about is the idea that it's not usually a people issue, it's a process issue. So there's not a process in place to check a certain thing, or there, you know, and we tend to look at individuals and people and blame. And like, that is not conducive to a positive working environment. I much prefer to focus on, okay, so what actually went wrong here? How can we make sure it doesn't happen again? And how can we look to the future and focus on the future rather than looking at the trail of destruction behind you, you know?
Yeah, no, I love that point. I think thinking about the learnings, thinking about a potential solution, don't look to make anybody a scapegoat or blame them or, you know, not promote them. Because otherwise, people are going to hide mistakes and then far bigger mistakes occur down the line.
Yeah. I think just building on that point as well, I think people should feel free to take responsibility when it was their mistake. And it's not about finding a scapegoat. It's about, as an individual, taking personal responsibility and saying, actually, I didn't flag that, or I told that person to do that thing, and not hiding that and not being in an environment where you feel that you have to hide it. Because I think that says a lot about you. It shows your vulnerability. It shows that you don't necessarily have all the answers. Leaders make mistakes too. But then equally, when you're talking about it more publicly, it's not kind of saying, oh, well, it was Samantha over there who made that mistake. It's thinking, what went wrong here? And just so we learn as an entire team or an entire department, this thing happened. Now, people obviously will know, and there'll be gossip of like, oh, well, I heard that that's what happened. But trying to stamp out that kind of thing, but focusing more on this is how to make sure that that doesn't happen in the future.
No, I love that. And I believe another big thing that you're into is this whole idea of imposter syndrome. Yes. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what it is and how people can manage it?
Absolutely. I'll do my best. So I'll share one example of imposter syndrome, or when I first heard about the term. So I had recently been promoted to this leadership position on the leadership team for Ireland. And I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, and I said, oh, well, you know, I think they didn't have anyone else for the role. I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to be doing here. And there was all of this kind of language that was coming up that I didn't realize at the time is a telltale sign of imposter syndrome. And she turned around to me and she said, it sounds like you have imposter syndrome. Now, that was the first time I had ever heard that term. Fast forward a few years, and I saw this call for people to share their experience of imposter syndrome for a newspaper. And I thought, I've had imposter syndrome, I'll share. And when I was reflecting then, I thought, oh, well, there was another time actually in Australia when I didn't know what imposter syndrome was. I definitely experienced it then. Definitely when I was setting up in business and I'm surrounded by all of these perceived successful people around me. And who am I to compete with them? And who am I to show up here and talk about whatever it is I wanted to talk about? That then later, a few months later, ended up in the Irish Times with my picture and everything. And then I talk about feeling like an imposter of, I'm talking about imposter syndrome in a national newspaper with my picture and everything. So from then, it sort of escalated, let's say, that I was invited to speak about it and I did my own research into it. And it's something people reach out to me all the time about, to talk about with their organizations. I set up an award winning at this stage, so it won an award this year, a program called Imposter to Empowered that focuses solely on imposter syndrome. But over time, I've realized it's not just about imposter syndrome. There's much more. And being a woman myself and having experienced the kinds of things that only women experience at work, I've kind of expanded my thinking to how do women manage their career better and how do you navigate those challenges that you have, whether it's in the environment. And this is from everything that I've done, everything I've experienced and the research I've done as part of my master's as well. So it's kind of all encompassing. It's not just about the imposter syndrome. There's more to it than just that. But that's sort of how things have evolved. Now, what it is, the research shows that around 70% of people will experience it at some point in their career. And I talk about the three different aspects of it. So it's this sense of, I don't deserve what I have. So you kind of feel unworthy of what you have. You feel like I just got lucky. So I was in the right place at the right time. But this underlying sense of dread of I'm going to be found out as a fraud. Because like we all doubt our abilities. I'm not sure if I'm good enough to do this, but this is more a sense that other people are going to find out and I'm going to be exposed as this fraud and people are going to know. So, you know, there's all of these fears associated with it. There's triggers associated with it that can exacerbate it as well. As I mentioned, I did my own research into it as well. And I do have a report on one of my websites, because I have two, that people can access and read. And I'm thinking of doing an updated version of that for 2024 as well. But I think people can relate to it. It's something that's often spoken about. But I think we need to talk about it more, because when we talk about it, we give people permission to feel that way and talk about it as being quite a natural feeling for people to have. And the thing with it is sometimes when we learn about it, it can be really freeing. But sometimes we can also think, oh, there is this thing called imposter syndrome, but you don't get it. I really am an imposter. So there's kind of two things where you can say, oh, imposter syndrome. Oh, it has a name. Oh, and most people get it. Oh, that makes me feel so good. Or no, you don't get it. Like, I really am an imposter. Like, there is this thing called imposter syndrome, but I am an imposter, you know? So I think just talking about the experiences that we have, especially because often we think we'll get to a certain level in our career and we'll suddenly feel like we have everything together, that we won't feel like that anymore. But that's usually not the case. Like, you're not going to suddenly reach a certain level in your career and then say, oh, I've made it now and I definitely don't feel like an imposter. In fact, the opposite is usually true. You see this widening gap between where you think you should be and how you feel inside.
I think that's a great point, because, you know, I remember when I was progressing up the ladders and you think, oh, that manager, oh, I'd love to be him because, or her, because they're making all this money and they have all this autonomy and all this decision making. And then when you get to that level, you think, oh my God, is that it?
Exactly. Like,
where's the payroll?
Yeah.
You know, where's all the autonomy? And you always think, the next person is in a better situation.
Exactly. Yeah,
But I totally get your point that you think when you reach a level, you will suddenly be this different person.
Yeah.
Actually, it's just the title that's changed.
Yeah.
And I think having it out there and letting people talk about it, it just gives us permission to realize, look, this is an issue. This is something a lot of people are going through. But that shouldn't detract from the things that we have done or make us feel any less worthy of being in that position.
Exactly. And I'm seeing a really positive move from a recruitment perspective. Companies themselves are putting at the bottom of their job ads, we're aware of the confidence gap. And if you feel like you can do this job, then do by all means apply. Like, you don't have to tick all of the boxes in order to apply. But if you think that you can add something, and I read recently, like, we've often talked that men need 6 out of 10 and women need, if they have 9 out of 10 of the criteria, they still won't apply. Apparently that's been debunked recently. So that's the first thing I'll say about that. I find it odd because anecdotally speaking, it makes a lot of sense to me in my own experience. But the other thing I wanted to share on that is, if you're ticking all of the requirements of a role and you can already do all of them, think about how bored you're going to be when you go into that role. If you can do everything already, there's no kind of
learning
room
for
growth. There's no opportunity to learn in that role. So just a kind of, again, a mindset shift for people to have. If you're looking into a new role, don't expect that you'll be able to tick the box on every single requirement, because if you can do everything already, then you might feel it's not as challenging as you would like.
I just love that. And moving on to job search, do you have any ideas or strategies if you're looking for work?
Yeah. So if we go back to the Happier at Work framework that I mentioned earlier, for me, what I learned doing my master's and what I didn't know when I worked in corporate, if you had asked me what my values were, I'd be like, I have no idea. I know that what the company's values are, and I know that I'm not experiencing those values, certainly. Like, one of them was simple, and I'm like, this is the most bureaucratic organization I've ever worked in. And if you're telling me that things are simple here, then a brilliant strategy is to understand what your values are as an individual. So it takes a while to do that, and it might be an ongoing process that you have. But I think asking some questions like, how do you spend your time, your money and your energy? What are the kinds of things that you surround yourself with? Do you have degrees and accolades on the wall? Do you have pictures of family? Do you have pictures of travels? Like, what does that say about you as a person? What are the things that really frustrate you about other people's behavior? So maybe they behave in a certain way, and that really goes, and I'll use a Family Guy phrase, it really grinds your gears, you know, it really kind of gets under your skin, really annoys you. What are those things? And maybe the opposite of that thing is a value, or that person is going against one of your values. So I think, first of all, understanding really clearly what your personal core values are, aside from the organization. And when you're looking for a job, come up with some questions that relate to those values to get a better understanding of when you're talking to the people there, how do they behave and how does that align with your values? And if you can come up with a set of questions to determine what the organization's behaviors are like on a day-to-day basis beyond what they talk about on their website and say what their values are those values really the lived experience of the people there? I know, Harsha, we've talked about this before, but having some stories to back up what you're talking about when it comes to that. And I think even higher level than that, looking over your career history, we did this as one of the exercises as part of my master's, and it was really eye-opening. If you just take a sheet of paper and you have, say, happiness on one side, and then across the bottom you have time, and you think about the different careers that you had and the levels of happiness. You know, happiness, it can be satisfaction, it could be whatever you want, enjoyment at work. And if you go over time and you kind of go up and down, you go, oh, that happened then, it helps you to identify what you really enjoyed so far in your career and maybe some of the things that were frustrating. And when you know those things, you know what to be on the lookout for when you're entering into a new organization, for example. So I think, so your overall career story, but then having stories to kind of to back up some of the things that you want to get across during the interview process as well. Another really important thing, and probably have two more points to make on this, apologies.
Get wild.
Understanding your strengths and being able to articulate what your strengths are, and ensuring that the role that you go into is really capitalizing on your strengths and allowing you to shine. I think that's really important. I think from an environmental perspective, it's the values piece, but then the specific role that you're really working to your strengths. And if you want to know what your strengths are, there's loads of different tools, free tools and paid tools out there. Go search for like something to understand your strengths better.
Yeah.
If you don't know what they are, you can also ask other people, like, what do I do that comes easily and naturally? Because sometimes things that we do well, we don't realize that we do them well because it's second nature to us. It's something that comes quite naturally. So that's the important thing on strengths. Now, the other aspect that I mentioned earlier that people don't necessarily talk about is needs satisfaction at work. So we all have needs at work. We have three universal needs for autonomy, relatedness, and competence. So a feeling of choice and control over what you do and how you do it. Relatedness being a sense of belonging or understanding the impact that your role has or you individually has on the company and the world. And then the competence piece is just feeling capable of doing your role. So making sure that you're sufficiently challenged in the role, that you're not too bored. But we have unique needs as well. So I think assessing on a role by role basis, will my needs be satisfied? So the autonomy piece, I think you can ask in interviews. So you don't have to necessarily ask about autonomy, but you can ask about the level of direction that is expected in the role, because you don't want too little direction either. You want to have enough freedom and flexibility to perform, but you want to be given enough guidance that you know what direction you want to take. But you can ask those kinds of questions in interviews. It's not a problem. Things like recognition, I think, are really important as well. How does the team get recognized? Is it public? Is it private? Or do they have a conversation and ask you how you'd like to be recognized? Things like how much challenge you could have in a role, how much variety, if variety is important to you, stability, status. There's so many different things. And again, with needs, you might find what your needs are by looking at previous roles and identifying where you felt really frustrated. So I've, for example, have had micromanagers in the past. That's my need for autonomy is not being met. So if you're worried about entering into an environment where you have a micromanager, maybe you can come up with some questions to ask to make sure that you're not entering into that same environment again.
No, I just love all those points, Aoife. I think there's a lot of valuable insights for our listeners there. And actually really emphasizing, ask those questions in the interview, use that time properly. Because actually that will also show the interviewer that you have actually thought about the role, thought about the company, and given it the respect it deserves. So great points.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to build on that. Like, I think early in my career, I used the scattergun approach. I just applied for anything using the same CV. I think that's outdated. I think you really need to find some core companies that you would really like to work for and that you have done the research and show that you really, really want that role as well. And also the fact that previously, certainly early in my career, interviews were very one way. Like, we are deciding, we have the power, we can give you this role. Now it's very two way. You get to decide, is this the right company for me? And I'm not going to say that you should be answering, or you should be asking the same number of questions of them that they are of you, because you can do a lot of this research online beforehand, but certainly come in armed with questions to determine whether this is the right role for you when you're coming to make that decision.
Yeah, all amazing points. But I just wanted to give you a chance to tell our listeners, how can they get in touch with you? I mean, clearly you're on LinkedIn, you've got your website, but yeah, over to you. How can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, well, since you are either watching or listening, then you can search for Happier at Work HQ on YouTube, or Happier at Work wherever you listen to your podcast. If you're listening today, like you say, I'm active on LinkedIn, so I'll give people my profile there. It's Aoife O'Brien. Or if you search for Happier at Work, I hopefully should come up with there as the one employee at Happier at Work, or Happier at Work podcast. Yeah. But I'll spell out my name as well for anyone who is listening who is not familiar with the spelling, and it's Aoife O'Brien, O'Brien, and it's pronounced Aoife O'Brien. And there was one more thing that I wanted to say. So I mentioned that I have two websites. So there's happieratwork.ie, and then there's impostersyndrome.ie. People will be able to access that report as well if they want to. So happieratwork.ie or impostersyndrome.ie.
Oh, fantastic. And yeah, I'd also like to say that, yeah, Aoife has a terrific podcast. I've been a guest, really enjoyed being on there. There's lots of valuable information apart from my interview on there. So yeah, lots of good, great guests that Aoife has got. So definitely check it out. Now, one final thing, Aoife, is there anybody you'd like to give a quick shout out to who's helped you in your life or your career? Not an Oscar speech, but just one or two people.
I think I'll give a shout out to one of my former bosses, Caroline, who she was my first experience of coaching. And at the time, I didn't know what that was, but she was able to ask me questions to enable me and empower me to solve my own issue. And I came away feeling so amazing after conversations with her. Like, I was having a particular challenge with someone who worked at a different agency, but we worked very closely together on the same client. So, you know, I had very little control over her and her attitude and her behaviors. And Caroline helped me. And like, I feel like she solved the problem for me, but I know she didn't. She solved it by asking me the right questions to solve my own problem. So definitely, like, that was a game changer for me.
Oh, fantastic. Well, shout out to Caroline for helping Aoife. But Aoife, it's been so much fun interviewing you today. Thank you so much for taking the time, and also for our two previous interviews as well. So yeah, it's been great fun. Love to see the progress that you're making with the podcast and your business, and wishing you all the best for the rest of the year.
Thank you so much, Harsha. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening and staying to the end. That was such a fun interview. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, please subscribe to the podcast, which is available on your favorite providers, and subscription is free. If you wish to learn more about any of the resources mentioned in this episode, please take a look at the show notes, which are available online. Thanks once again for listening. Wishing you success with your career. I hope you will join me again in the future.